History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask some questions and then invest enough time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks the 78th anniversary of a day that changed the world. The radio station you're listening to right now may have carried these words from President Harry Truman on August 6, 1945.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in the first attack to avoid, in so far as possible, the killing of civilians. But that attack is only a warning of things to come. If Japan does not surrender, bombs will have to be dropped on her war industries, and unfortunately, thousands of civilian lives will be lost. I urge Japanese civilians to leave industrial cities immediately and save themselves from destruction. I realized the tragic significance of the atomic bomb. Its production and its use were not lightly undertaken by this government, but we knew that our enemies were on the search for it. We know now how close they were to finding it. And we knew the disaster which would come to this nation and to all peace-loving nations, to all civilization, if they had found it first. That is why we felt compelled to undertake the long and uncertain and costly labor of discovery and production. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. Having found the bomb, we have used it. We have used it against those who attack us without warning at Pearl Harbor, against those who have starved and beaten and executed American prisoners of war, against those who have abandoned all pretense of obeying international laws of warfare. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
We know that, unfortunately, a second bomb would have to be dropped on Nagasaki before Imperial Japan surrendered. It's always amazed me that President Truman didn't even know about the Manhattan Project until after President Franklin D. Roosevelt died in April of 1945. The dawn of the nuclear era and the events and decisions before, during, and after the deployment of the atomic bomb have drawn renewed interest and even debate with the release of the Hollywood blockbuster Oppenheimer, centering around the legendary physicist who spearheaded those efforts. Over the years, we've heard plenty of perspectives about the bomb here on Hometown Heroes, from sailors aboard the ill-fated USS Indianapolis who delivered components of it to Tinian, to Marines there on that island who helped unload the precious cargo. Of course, we've heard from people who visited Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the immediate aftermath of those devastating days, even a pilot who saw the Hiroshima blast from miles away while flying his own B-29 bombing mission. And of course, we've heard from countless World War II veterans who've told us they firmly believe the atomic bomb saved their lives by preventing the planned invasion of Japan and the mind-blowing number of casualties that would have resulted on both sides. I hadn't planned on going to see this new 3-hour movie, Oppenheimer. I knew it definitely wasn't a family film, and I'm not here to tell you you should or shouldn't see it. But a headline on my news feed got my attention. It said, Oppenheimer film reignites debate over whether the atomic bomb was necessary. I knew there was one person whose perspective I had to get because I knew he was one of, if not the last surviving member of the 509th Composite Group, which had the responsibility of actually delivering the bomb. If you're a longtime Hometown Heroes listener, you may remember Norris Jernigan. He turned 98 in June, but he's still driving, still singing in his church choir in Visalia, California, and still traveling to places like the Mid-Atlantic Air Show in Reading, Pennsylvania, Wendover Field in Utah, where he first took on the burden of secrecy that surrounded this project. He's even been to the Trinity site in New Mexico where the bomb was tested, and he has the sand turned to glass called Trinitite as proof. I decided to call up Norris, and if he was up for seeing this film, then I would be too. So this week, we went and watched Oppenheimer. The other folks in the theater had no idea the guy with the World War II veteran hat on is one of our last living links to this chapter of history. I don't think we'll have any spoilers here if you haven't seen the film, but I thought you might be interested in Norris Jernigan's reaction to Oppenheimer, fresh after sitting through 3 hours of it.
Well, I think just seeing him literally crucified the way they did, just to whittle him down to nothing, when the guy was really a genius. Weird, no question about that, but weird. But as far as the movie goes, I think there were a few explicit scenes that didn't necessarily need to be in there to tell the story of Oppenheimer. He was a brilliant person. He had his idiosyncrasies, and heavens knows, people resented the attention he got and the popularity he won. And some of them, I think, were out to cut him down. So it was kind of, but that's the way it happened. So all in all, the guy that played Oppenheimer, I thought, did a good job depicting him, because it was he depicted pretty well the character of Oppenheimer. Never had the privilege of meeting the man, but we knew about him because our part of the Manhattan Project was delivery of the bomb, but nothing to do with the development of it. So all of this I learned about Oppenheimer after the fact.
And as they showed the buildup of Los Alamos and everything that was happening there, did you find yourself thinking about what you might have been doing at some of those same time periods in the lead up to Hiroshima?
Oh, yeah. We were in training. Well, we went into training. The 509th Composite Group was activated on December 17th, 1944, and we went into extensive training. But actually, our 393rd Bomb Squadron, of which I served, we were activated in the spring of 1944 and had completed all the overseas training, and we're waiting for overseas orders when orders came through sending us to Wendover, and we found out when we got there that we had been selected as a top squadron to be the bomb squadron of the 509th Composite Group.
And I know you've always told me about, you know, the only way it was referred to was as the gadget, and the film held to that. On the other side of this thing, in Los Alamos and wherever they were, they referred to the gadget too.
Yes, that's right. We called it the gadget most of the time, or the gimmick, one or the other, back and forth. Never referred to it as an atomic bomb until after the Hiroshima drop.
You know, one thing that struck me, you've told me before about, you know, the secrecy required where you were. The film captures the secrecy that was supposed to be in effect at Los Alamos and potential flaws in that too. But I was just really struck by the timeline, even to the point here in mid-July, they don't even know if it's going to work, and they have the Trinity test, and you're already on Tinian at that point with the squadron, correct?
That's correct, yes. We arrived over there, I arrived the end of May, and our flight crews and all the rest of the people that flew over arrived by the middle of June. And in July, our crews, flight crews, started flying practice bombs, missions to Japan using 10,000-pound TNT bombs to experience the dropping of this huge, heavy bomb, because the size of it was enormous. It just barely fit up in the bomb bay of the B-29.
And I want to get your perspective on, you know, the morality of the bomb. You've been asked about that many times over the years, and this film kind of reignites that debate. But, you know, I'm just struck by the unknowns along the way. The guys that have invested years of their life and billions and all the brilliant minds, they don't know if it's going to work. Then once they do know it does work and they hope it's going to work, when they drop it for real, they still need to get it there. And you have the Indianapolis, who delivers these components and then gets sunk right afterwards in the biggest naval tragedy of all time, and then the actual bomb with the guys that you knew, and then they put some of this weight on their shoulders too. You ever think about that, how the chain of events? I mean, it's a chain reaction explosion that changed the world, but the chain of events that had to have everything go right for it to go down the way it did?
Yeah, it was really mind-boggling how quickly they developed that thing. When we went overseas, we didn't know that the thing had not been brought to the point of being tested yet, even. When the test was successful, they used a plutonium bomb for that test. The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was a uranium bomb, and it had never been tested. That was the test. I guess we just had faith that the bomb would get there eventually, but we were getting a little impatient. By the end of July, you know, we began to wonder, well, are these TNT 10,000-pound bombs what were talked about all this time? Our group intelligence officer said, no, not yet, just wait. And so it was right after that then. Things started developing, and all of a sudden missions were planned to use this new secret weapon. And we had been told originally that our squadron and the group would be handling a new secret weapon that, if successful, should shorten the war by at least 2 years. That's what we were looking forward to and expecting. And when the first one was dropped, we were about ready to pack and get ready to come home. We thought that would be it, but it was not. So the second one was dropped. After the second one was dropped, two flight crews were dispatched back to the United States to be on hand to start shuttling the bombs over by air to get them there. They felt they could produce one for us at least one a month, at least. There were other targets that would have gone also. The third bomb was ready and ready to be brought over to us. I understand it actually got loaded on one of the B-29s. To come over, and they were in flight, but they had not left the limits of the United States yet, and the Japanese surrendered, so that flight was aborted. The third bomb did arrive over at Tinian.
Every time I have the privilege of catching up with Norris Jernigan, I'm so impressed all over again. We're going to come back around at the end of the show to his reflections after watching this new film, Oppenheimer, centered around the world-changing event that took place 78 years ago this weekend on August 6th, 1945, when that bomb called Little Boy was released from the Enola Gay over Hiroshima. The Oppenheimer film captures how much went into that from a scientific perspective, how uncertain it all was, how some of those physicists actually feared it could set off an incessant chain reaction that would destroy the entire world. It shows the rapid construction of Los Alamos and much of the big picture. But Norris Jernigan's personal story gives us another view. He was one of many who would be sworn to secrecy and have that secrecy tested under various means of surveillance. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can find a photo of Norris sticking his young face out of the cockpit window of the most famous B-29 in history, the Enola Gay. We'll hear about his connection to that plane, but his inspiration for leaving high school after his junior year to enlist in the Army Air Corps was the dream of becoming a pilot himself.
Well, went into active duty and was sent to Shepherd Field, Texas for the Army basic training, because back then the Air Force was part of the Army. It was right. A division of the Army. Took my basic training there and then went on to the next step of the cadet program. Was sent to Denver and enrolled in Denver University for a semester. And that's where we had our first flying lessons. It was some small private field near Denver. I think his name was Hayden Field, but I'm not really positive about that anymore. But had my 10 hours of flight instruction there. Then, after the semester was ended, came time for our school squadron to be sent to a classification center to decide whether we qualified for further pilot training or whether we would go to navigator school or bombardier school or somewhere else. Well, when we got to, it was in Santa Ana, California. When we got there, we checked daily to see what the list looked like, where we would go. The pilot list, the bombardier list, and the navigator list wasn't growing very fast, but the somewhere else list was. One day there was my name on the somewhere else, and so that was the end of my cadet training. We wondered why, because about 2/3 of my school squadron was eliminated.
Wow.
The reason they gave us was that they were gaining a surplus of aviation students to go on to the next step. So, you know, in the military, you just can't have people sitting around doing nothing. So we were eliminated from the program to free up the backlog of people waiting for further training. They decided to send me to Amarillo, Texas, to go to airplane mechanic school. There again, the wisdom of the military decided I was mechanically inclined, and about as mechanically inclined as a black cat, I guess you'd say. Anyhow. Went down there, and we laid around there waiting for the next class to start up. And after about 4 or 5 weeks, they called us together and said that they had decided to close that school, and we would be sent to a redistribution center, which was in Salt Lake City. Set up there, and was there about 2 weeks, I guess, while they were trying to decide where to send everybody. They were just funneling them through there and sending them out. And finally, they said, well, they're closing so many of the schools now. We're going to be sending you out to tactical groups that are training for overseas duty, and you'll be going out of here as an on-the-job trainee. So they sent me to Fairmont, Nebraska, to become part of a B-29 group. Well, I'd never heard of a B-29, but anyhow, we went to Fairmont, Nebraska, worked in the motor pool for a little while because they sent me out as a truck driver. There again, the wisdom of the Army.
They keep checking boxes you weren't willing to check for yourself, huh?
Yeah, but, you know, you have decisions made for you, which I wasn't used to. And anyhow, I was there just about a month, maybe. And as the number of people grew, they finally broke us into three different squadrons. And it was the 393rd Bomb Squadron, the 398th Bomb Squadron, and the 421st Bomb Squadron. I wound up in the 393rd Bomb Squadron. And one day, one of the guys that was in the administrative office, which we referred to as the orderly room, was going through the personnel records and noticed that I had been with the cadet program and I just had completed a semester at Denver University. Called me in and said, I see you were in the cadet program. What are you doing driving a truck? And I said, well, you don't argue. You do and go where you're told and you do what you're told to do. We had three answers, yes, sir, no excuse, sir. Anyhow, he said, well, I tell you, there's an opening in the intelligence office here in the squadron if you're interested. It requires some typing. And I said, well, that's no problem. I took a semester of high school typing. So he said, well, if you're interested, go over and talk to him. So I did. I went over to the intelligence office, and they decided to give me a try. So I went into the intelligence office as an on-the-job trainee. And I was with the 393rd Bomb Squadron intelligence office for the rest of the time I was in the service.
And that would really change your life.
Yes.
I'm curious, the time when you were in the cadet program, when you actually got to fly, what was that like for you, and what were you flying?
Piper Cubs.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I had never been up in an airplane before. That first takeoff, it was just so exciting, you know. About the second or third lesson, they switch around their instructors. I had a woman pilot instructor. And in the old Piper Cub, they had what they called a Gosport. It was the communications intercom system, which was really almost like the old can with the string to the other can. It was a tube connected to just like funnels that you would talk into. And started down the runway, and she said, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder. She got to the high pitch, and I got so confused. I hit the left rudder, and we went out across the field. I thought, oh, boy, I'm washed out of this, too, now. Anyhow, we circled around, got on the runway again, and made a perfect takeoff. So I redeemed myself, but I don't know why I got so confused that I would go, I knew right from left, but that high-pitched screaming, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder. Because you had to ride the right rudder because of the torque. You drift to the left. To stay on the runway, you had to stay on that rudder. That was exciting. And then when it came to the what they call the five-hour check, after you've had 5 hours of instruction, then you had somebody come in that you didn't even know that was checked you out and made a perfect takeoff. Went out to the practice area where I always practiced. Went through all the routine of the stalls and everything else that I was supposed to do. And he said, okay, now take us back to the airport. Where's the airport? Always before, the instructor flew it out there to the practice area and then flew it back to the airport and then turned it over to the student to land the plane. I remember the railroad track that we kept almost following, and so I thought, well, where's a railroad track? And I spotted it, and so I just wheeled around and followed that thing, and sure enough, it took us back to the airport. Redeemed myself again. But I was, you know, I was crushed when I got washed out of the program because, you know, you make such a big thing back home about you're going to become a pilot. I was going to fly a B-17, the biggest airplane they had at that time. And now tell them, well, I'm a airplane mechanic or I'm a truck driver. But, you know, ego enters into it, I guess. But anyhow, it was tough being washed out of the program.
And little did you know that you would end up with a lifelong connection to an even bigger plane, a B-29,
yes.
Probably the most famous B-29 of all time.
Absolutely. And when we first were cut off into squadrons, we became the squadrons for the 504th Bomb Group. And they were training for overseas duty. And they call them a tactical unit, which means they're actually seriously training for overseas duty. We, at first, didn't have any B-29s. They were using B-17s to begin their training. And then when the first B-29 showed up, I just couldn't believe what a huge aircraft that was. Of course, now it's very small compared to what's in the air now. But then the B-29 started arriving, and so they transitioned into the B-29. And the 393rd Bomb Squadron was really making great headway in their training. We started our training in the spring of 1944, and by the end of August, all of the squadrons, especially the 393rd, was complete with their training. They were ready to go overseas. All of a sudden, orders came through transferring the 393rd Bomb Squadron away from the 504th and sending us to Wendover Field, Utah. Well, never heard of Wendover Field because I'd never been there before, but anyhow, we got to Wendover, and what a cultural shock that was out there on the salt flats, away from everything, 120 miles west of Salt Lake City. The little town of Wendover was nothing. It was just a small casino and then a small state line hotel was all that was there, really, and a few citizens.
And there was a reason they wanted you all in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly, and we found that out later. Well, about the second day we were there, the enlisted men, I understand the officers were pulled into one of the theaters and briefed, and the enlisted men in our squadron, we were told to assemble out in front of the orderly room. This lieutenant colonel hopped up on the back of a truck so he could see everybody and said, "All right, men, gather around, I want to talk to you." So he said, introduced himself, he says, "I'm Lieutenant Colonel Paul Tibbetts, and I want you to know that you've been brought here for a purpose. You're going to become part of an organization that's going to be handling a new secret weapon that, if successful, should shorten the war by at least 2 years. Now, it's top secret, high security. You're not to talk to anybody. You're not to tell anybody where you're stationed. You're not to talk to anybody about what you're doing. You're not supposed to talk to each other. So I want you now to all go on a two-week furlough. Go home, get rested up, come back, because we're going to go into an intense training program and get ready to go overseas." Well, of course, we were so excited to find out we were going to be something special. But he stressed again, remember, top secret, security is high, so don't tell anybody anything. So we left to go on a two-week leave, but what we didn't know, he wasn't concerned about us getting rested up. It was a test to see if anybody could keep their mouth shut. Some of the guys, when they got home, had telegrams waiting for them to report back to the base immediately. And they found out when they got back to the base, they had just casually mentioned something to somebody about where they were stationed or going to be involved in something special or whatever, whatever they talked about. There was one story that was circulated, and we never could find out whether it was true or not, but it certainly made an impression on us that they really meant business about this security. It seems that one of the guys that was going on leave, while he was waiting to get his bus, train, or airplane, wherever it was, decided to go in the bar and have a drink while he was waiting. So he was sitting at this bar, and a Catholic priest came in and sat down beside him. And, of course, he struck up a conversation. "I see, my son, you're in the service." "Yes." "Where are you stationed?" "Oh, we're out at Wendover." "Wendover? What in the world are you doing there?" "Well, we're not sure. It's some top-secret project you're going to be involved in." "Aha! Yeah. Okay, so he went on home, and he had a telegram waiting for him. When he got back to the base, he was met by the so-called Catholic priest, who was in a business suit, was part of FBI security. We never knew who it was, and maybe it was nobody. Maybe it was just a story that was circulated to catch our attention, which it certainly did, because we realized that they meant business. You didn't know who you were talking to when you left that base.
Was it hard for you to keep that secret? Were there times you were tempted?
Oh, heavens, yes. But fortunately, I somehow or other kept it.
And if he hadn't, he wouldn't have had his connection to the history that unfolded 78 years ago this weekend. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, more on this 98-year-old's connection to the atomic bomb, and before we're done, a few final reflections after his viewing of the new film Oppenheimer. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the 78th anniversary of the Enola Gay's fateful mission to Hiroshima by catching up with one of our last surviving connections to that chapter in history, 98-year-old Norris Jernigan of Visalia, California. I had the privilege of watching the new film Oppenheimer with Norris this week, and we'll get some final thoughts about that before we're done. When we left off, he was a teenager sworn to secrecy about a new secret weapon his 393rd Bomb Squadron had been told would shorten World War II by at least 2 years. So how much of an idea did they have about what that secret weapon might be?
Being of the Army Air Corps, we assumed it was some kind of a bomb because that was the only weapon the Air Force was using, was bombs. So we assumed that it was some new type of explosive that would be used. Little did we know. Maybe some of the guys had college physics, maybe a higher education, figured out that it might be that. I certainly didn't. I had no knowledge of anything of that area, of what it might be, but I just trusted that it was a new type bomb that we'd be using and would shorten the war. And of course, that was the goal of everybody, was to get that war over, because it was such a nasty, bloody war out there in the Pacific, and Europe too, as far as that goes. And we understood after the fact, I guess it was after we even got back from overseas, the original plan was to put this group together and then split it in half, send half of it to Europe and half of it to the Pacific, and simultaneously drop two atomic bombs, one on Germany and one on Japan. With the war winding down in Europe, because it was so close to being over by the time we were ready to go overseas in spring of 1945, if that was the plan, it was abandoned because we all went over to the island of Tinian.
But I'm sure there are a lot of fascinating months in between there. And before we hear about some of the things you experienced at Wendover and what it was like to go over to Tinian, how about explaining to us what your duties were? What were you responsible for on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I was assigned to the intelligence office as a clerk, intelligence clerk, which meant I typed reports and I helped put together folders made up of maps and aerial photographs and whatever else you could put in the folder to help them complete their mission. Then when they would come back from their mission, they were always interviewed and interrogated, and then I would type up the interrogation report. So a good part of it at first was just typing. My assignment, once we were overseas, the Squadron Intelligence Office was combined with the 509th Group Intelligence Office so that we were just one large office. And Lieutenant Jim Hinchy, who was part of the 393rd Squadron, was assigned the duty of Air Sea Rescue Officer, and his portion of the briefings for crews that would be flying missions would to brief them on the air-sea rescue. And he kind of adopted me as his assistant to help him with that. And so I would spend quite a bit of time working with him to put together information on where the submarines were operating and where the fleets were operating and where any amphibian planes might be operating. Because we received a teletype every day. Many people don't know what a teletype is. But back then, we didn't have computers. So it was a teletype that we received either from the wing command or island command, I don't remember which now, that gave the location of all of these things, the submarines and the fleets and the amphibian planes, so that we could put together information for them that when they would fly their mission, when they would leave Japan, if they were shot up and knew they were going to have to ditch in the ocean, if you can fly to this longitude, latitude, go ahead and put out your distress call and ditch in the ocean, you'll be picked up. So we had that information to put together for that briefing. So that was my main responsibility once we were overseas to work with him.
Well, and I'm just imagining, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm thinking about all the guys I've talked to over the years, and so many of them, they only know what they're experiencing. You know, they know their mission, or if they're on the ground, they know, you know, this situation, this fight, this foxhole, this battle. If you're typing all these reports, you probably have more of a view of the big picture than most people in your squadron.
Yes, that would be a good assessment of that, yes. Not the complete knowledge. We never referred to these bombs as atomic bombs until after the first one was dropped. To us, it was the gimmick or the gadget that we referred to.
And I'm interested in some of the things that were happening there at Wendover, because, again, we know now when the bomb was dropped and when the second bomb was dropped and everything that happened as a result, but at the time you guys don't know anything, and this is all uncharted territory. So what was happening at Wendover, and what did you experience there?
When we went into training there, they started sending the crews to a different site to do their practice bombing missions, because they were using a heavier bomb than what the normal bomb would be. Somewhere down on the Southern California desert, when the crews would disappear for a few days, when they'd appear back at Wendover, where you guys been? Well, we were at Destination X or Destination Y. That's all. You didn't ask anything further than that. When the 509th was made up, it only had one bomb squadron, and the 393rd was it. There were other squadrons in the 509th. Each had their function. You didn't talk to anybody in the other squadrons because you never knew who you were talking to. Just an interesting note, when we arrived at Wendover, there was a elderly lady, Miss Merrill, on the base that was in charge of the furnishings for all of the day rooms. Well, it just so happened that the barracks that we had been put in, the group that I was with, it went into the barracks, was a room that we thought we could convert that into our own day room. We were told we'll have to deal with Miss Merrill because she's in charge of the day rooms. So we did, and we were able to furnish that and have our own day room. She was just a grandmotherly type, lovable person, loved everybody, and we were her grandchildren, and she talked to us, and so friendly. You go over to her apartment, and oh, you have to sit down and have a cup of iced tea. We all loved Mom Merrill. That's what we referred to as Mom Merrill. One day she wasn't there anymore. Nobody knew where she was. Later on, we found out that she was actually FBI. It wasn't. She wasn't what she was supposed to be at all, you know.
She was there to keep an eye on you.
Yeah. So there again, you realize, gosh, I don't know if I ever said anything to her I shouldn't have or not. But, you know, she was so friendly and such a sweet little lady. But we didn't find that out until years later, that actually that's what happened to her, that she was FBI and she was moved on.
Does that make you wonder if there are more revelations that could still take place, that you could still find out something that none of you have ever heard before?
Yes, I'm sure of it.
And what about the development of this weapon? Was there any awareness at all of things being tested, of capabilities being learned?
Not at my level. Colonel Tibbetts, of course, he was at the very beginning, he was given the task of putting together a military unit that could drop this special bomb. He knew about the bomb. He visited Los Alamos, and he was in touch with people higher up than him. So he knew about it, and maybe Colonel Payette, the group intelligence officer, he may have known too, but very few people knew what it was. As far as the development, I had no idea where it was being developed, and neither did any of the rest of the guys either, as far as I know. No idea where this thing was being developed. We didn't even know that they were going to test that one on the New Mexico desert on July 16th of 1945. Didn't even know that they had tested one until after the two bombs were dropped. Then we found out, well, yeah, they had tested the plutonium bomb.
So when you get the word we're heading overseas, what did that mean for you?
Excitement. We thought, well, finally we're going to get this thing done that we're supposed that we've been brought here to do. And so, yeah, we were all excited about getting over there. And I went over on board ship, and I wasn't one of the few that got to fly over with the B-29s, and we had a troop carrier squadron as part of the 509th also that flew C-54s, four-engine transport. So they transported a lot of the people. So, yeah, I was excited about getting, let's get over there and get this thing done. When we first got there, the crews arrived, started flying some practice missions with conventional bombs, flying over to Marcus Island or somewhere, testing their accuracy for dropping any bomb. Then, in July, got word that they would start flying missions to Japan. So they started flying what we call the pumpkin bombs, which was the housing that was used for the plutonium bomb, really, with was full of TNT. The thing was a 10,000-pound bomb, did a lot of damage when it was dropped, but it still wasn't the gimmick. Well, after a couple of weeks of that type of mission, we began to wonder, well, maybe this is the thing. Is it a big flop as far as I was concerned? It just, you know, it's a big bomb. It did a lot of damage, but, you know, with only one bomb, well, the B-29, not ours, but the others, were equipped to put multiple bombs in their bomb bays. You load a B-29 up full of conventional bombs. If you dropped all of those bombs on a target, it would do as much damage or more than what these one TNT bombs were doing. When President Truman, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin met in Potsdam for the Potsdam Conference, they call it, they put together what was called the Potsdam Proclamation, directed to the Japanese Empire, demanding that they surrender unconditionally. And the Japanese received it, reviewed it, and on July 29th formally rejected it. They wanted to fight on. So that's at the point, I guess, that President Truman finally decided, all right, go ahead and use the atomic bombs.
I've always been amazed by the fact that he didn't even know about the Manhattan Project or about these nuclear capabilities until Roosevelt died and he became president, right?
Exactly. When he was sworn in, he had no knowledge of the atomic bomb project. And Stimson called him aside and clued him in. And that was the first he heard about. And I think that's a tragedy, that a man stands in the wings that's going to step in as president if something happens to the president, is denied knowledge of what's going on. You know, what in the world thinking is that?
I guess that underscores how secretive this whole thing was.
Even so,
yeah,
there were people that knew about it. Of course, Roosevelt knew about it because he's the one that instigated the startup of studying the use of uranium for that type of purpose. Others knew about it. Stimson knew about it. General Groves was headed up the atomic bomb project. General Hap Arnold knew about it. A lot of people knew about it, but the vice president of the United States is the second most important person in our government. And he was denied the knowledge of it, which just did not make sense. And I have never been able to understand the thinking of not briefing him on what's going on, because Roosevelt's health was getting so bad that they just expected him to drop dead any time, you know. Mm-hmm. They knew he was not going to be able to serve another 4 years. His health would not hold up that long. They knew that Harry Truman was going to become the president. And you don't clue the guy in? My gosh.
And it adds to the respect we have for how difficult that decision must have been for a guy who this is all new information to, and he's so new to the job.
Yes.
For you, out on Tinian, so you're a 20-year-old kid. This is your first time overseas.
Yes.
What was it like there? And I'm interested in what you shared a second ago, that as they're dropping these pumpkin bombs, there's some scuttlebutt, oh, maybe that's what the gadget's been the whole time, the gimmick, this is it.
Yes.
How did that all kind of unfold for you, and what was life like so far away from home for you?
Well, you know, I had my 20th birthday in June of 1945, so I was just barely 20 years old when these bombs were dropped. You know, it was exciting. When we first arrived there, we were put in a tent area, which was okay. We survived in the tent area, and we were a few weeks in the tent area when all of a sudden we were told the whole group was going to be moving into other facilities, and they moved us into what had been the CB's unit housing, which was all Quonset huts, very nice ones, and a very nice layout camp. It was complete. It had everything. It had a chapel, it had a theater, it had offices, it had barracks, it had a big mess hall. When we moved from the tent area to the Quonset hut area, life was nice. You know, I really enjoyed my time on Tinian because I knew I was a part of something big. Plus, it wasn't all that bad. When we got off the ship, at first, they didn't have any place for us, so we were living in pup tents for a few days. And that was pretty rugged, spread out in what used to be a cane field. It had been a farm. The civilians that lived on the island of Tinian, farmers, used human feces as their fertilizer. So we were told, don't eat any of the cane, don't chew any of that cane. It could be harmful to you. But every day it would rain. You could just depend on it. Be bright, bright sunshine, and all of a sudden one cloud would seem to come up, and all of a sudden it would just pour down rain. Then all of a sudden the cloud would move on, the sun would come out again. Then the steam starts rising from the soil. So you could just imagine the odor that came with it. So it was rather unpleasant. But that didn't last too long, so we survived it. And then we went into the regular tent area that was, tents were spread on platforms, so we were up off the ground, on wood floors at least. And then from there to the Quonset hut area. But we weren't too popular when we hit Tinian. We showed up over there with all kinds of priorities. 15 B-29s with no armor and no gun turrets, with all kinds, like I say, all kinds of priorities that the other guys had been over there for months slushing around in the mud and the slush and air crews flying missions and being shot down. And here this bunch of pansies show up with 15 airplanes with just a tail gun, two 50 caliber tail guns. Right away they wanted to know what we were up to, and nobody could tell them anything. So there was all kinds of scuttlebutt around the island about what group was all about. And one guy even wrote a poem about the 509th is winning the war. After August 6th, the tone changed because they realized we did have a mission over there after all.
What was August 6th like for you?
Oh, it was exciting. Around August 1st, we realized that things were starting to happen because all of a sudden people started showing up. A lot of people in khaki uniforms with no military insignia, which meant they weren't military. Civilians showing up. A lot of high-ranking officers showing up. Even a naval officer showing up. What in the world is the Navy doing here? So we knew that things were happening because all these secret meetings all of a sudden that only certain people were allowed to go in. We had a military police squadron as well in the group. You know, it just wouldn't be anything to notice that on the chapel, one of the MPs, one on either side of the door standing there with their weapons, just guarding the door. That meant there was a secret meeting going on in there. And a lot of the briefings were held in there. There were several briefings, and they were held at different places, but the main ones, I think, used the little chapel, which was another Quonset hut converted into a chapel. So we knew that things were starting to happen. So we had a lot of excitement. All these high-ranking officers showing up. It was funny. One day, a group of us were just sitting around talking with some of these new people that had shown up, and I was sitting next to this person that was quite a bit older than me, but we were just having a good conversation, and I just happened to turn around and look on, and on his collar was a star. He was a general, General Farrell, and that was where I met General Farrell, just sitting, talking to him. He was just a regular guy, you know. Anyhow, we knew that things were starting to happen, and then when the mission was scheduled, we knew that it was the big one.
How did you know?
That was the information we got in the intelligence office, that the bomb is here, it's going to be delivered. August 6th was selected as the date, and Colonel Tibbetts was going to fly the airplane. So he took over the crew of Captain Lewis, and Captain Lewis had to move over to to the co-pilot seat. That was the privilege of the commanding officer. If he wanted to fly the airplane, the normal airplane commander would move over and become co-pilot. But anyhow, it was determined that Colonel Tibbets was going to be the airplane commander on that mission. Then all these secret briefings we knew were briefing for this big mission that was going to happen. And we were all sitting around the office. All the briefings had been completed, and we knew that they were going to be taking off that night, sometime after midnight of August 6th, and sitting around in the intelligence office waiting to go down to the flight line and see them off. And my buddy Ed Schlesinger and I, who had the same capacity jobs in the intelligence office, we were buddies as well. We were getting so heavy, I had not to go to sleep. Our sergeant finally said, "Hey, you guys are just, you're going to go to sleep here. Why don't you go on back to the Quonset hut, lay down. As soon as we get ready to go down to the flight line, I'll come get you." Well, that was good news for us, so we went dashing off to the barracks, to the Quonset hut. Flopped down on the bed. When I opened my eyes, it was the next morning. He didn't come get us, so we missed the takeoff. Anyhow, they took pictures that night. It was a big affair. They had floodlights down there, and they were recording, talking to the crew members, and, of course, Colonel Tibbets. The crew got in the airplane. They cranked up the engines and just started moving to taxi out to the runway, and Colonel Tibbets opened the side window and leaned out and waved. Well, when I saw that picture, I thought, I've got to have my picture taken the same way. So a few days later, after that mission, some of us from the intelligence office took the office jeep and went down to the flight line. And so I had my picture taken looking out the window of Enola Gay.
You can find that photo at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, more reflections from Norris Jernigan about that chapter of history, receiving more attention this weekend because of the 78th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, also coinciding with the release of the feature film Oppenheimer. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, catching up with 98-year-old Norris Jernigan this week because of his connection to the atomic bomb. It was 78 years ago this week that the world changed with the advent of a weapon that threatened our globe's very existence. The film Oppenheimer has also revived interest and even debate around what happened back then. And as an intelligence clerk with the 509th Composite Group's 393rd Bomb Squadron, Norris Jernigan was there on Tinian when the Enola Gay and Boxcar took off and returned from their fateful atomic missions.
You talk about lives. In the military, we were all just numbers, and every action, they knew that certain numbers of them would be killed, but it was necessary to carry out the missions.
I've had so many people through the years say, "Oh, thank God for what you guys did." My grandfather was on Okinawa with the invading force in training, getting ready for that invasion. Or my grandfather or my uncle or my dad was on Philippines with the invading force. What you guys did stopped that invasion. So they said, "Thank you for that, or I wouldn't be here." You know, and they're right. So it would have been the bloodiest battle in the world's history, as far as I'm concerned. Oh, I've heard all kinds of speculation about, oh, no, it wouldn't have been that, you know, but just face the facts, for heaven's sakes.
Colonel Paul Tibbetts, and by the way, the airplane name was the Nola Gay, he had that name painted on the fuselage of the airplane the day before they flew that raid on Hiroshima. And it was his mother's name because he so respected his mother. She's the one that encouraged him to go ahead and get into flying. And his father had a different idea. He had determined that young Paul would go to the medical school. But young Paul was taking flying lessons, and he just learned to love flying, and he wanted to continue that. So his mother told him, well, if that's where your heart is, go for it. And she helped explain that to his dad, which was necessary. He had never done it alone, but his dad finally said, well, I don't care. If you want to go ahead and kill yourself, go ahead and do it. Well, as a result, young Paul became an Army Air Corps cadet, took the flight training, got his wings, and eventually wound up being an airplane group commander of a B-17 group in Europe. He was given the assignment to put together this 509th group that would be entrusted with dropping the two atomic bombs. Anyhow, Colonel Tibbetts stayed in the military and retired as a brigadier general, and he used to come to some of our reunions when he could, but almost invariably when he did come to one of our reunions, there'd be a reporter there that would shove a microphone in his face and say, aren't you sorry for what you did? So he finally developed a response to that and had it put in print that said, the morality of dropping that bomb was not my business. I was given a military mission to complete, and I did it to the best of my ability, period. And that says it all.
We never learn from our wars. We think we do. We think, oh, this is the one that'll end all wars. Well, that's what World War I was for. That's what World War II was for. Well, we've been in war ever since World War II in one place or another. It hasn't ended the wars. You know, as long as there's people on this earth, there's going to be wars in some form or another until the end of time when Christ comes back. He'll put a stop to the whole thing, and it'll be put set straight again. But as long as there's people, and people choose to hate, and there is so much hate in the world right now, that how can we ever get together and solve any problems? There's only one answer, and that's Christ. He's the answer, and if we would get the whole world to turn to Christ, that would solve all of our problems.
When August 6th comes around on the calendar every year, what do you think about? What crosses your mind on that date each year?
I'm still proud of the fact that I was part of something big. My job was not that big. I was a clerk in the intelligence office. I never touched either of those bombs. Never actually saw one. The one I saw was covered with canvas, so I didn't actually see the bomb. So, you know, just knowing that I was part of something that big that at least stopped war for a little while. That war in the Pacific was so, so cruel and bloody. It was terrible, absolutely terrible for both sides. At that point in my life, I had a great strong hate for the Japanese. But once the war was over, I feel like it's time to set things aside, restore our respect for each other, and let's go on from there and try to make it a better world. And I think in a lot of ways that happened for a while. You know, I just have to assume that I'm here, still here, because God has something for me to do. I don't know what it is. May never know. But I think once it's accomplished, if it's ever completely accomplished, then God will say, okay, come on home.
And I know you have been all over the country and in many places talking about this. You're at events where people want your autograph. They want to take a picture with you. You're associated with this. And I was recently with all the USS Indianapolis folks at their reunion. They're down to one survivor from that disaster out of 316 who survived. Do you have any idea how many guys are left that served in the 509th during that time period?
When we had our last reunion in 2017, there were just two of us there, myself and Larry DeCour. I just got word yesterday that Larry DeCour had passed away. So very likely I'm the last person member of the 509th. If there are any others still living, they cannot, evidently cannot travel anymore and are out of touch. So as far as I know, I'm the last surviving member.
In being aware of that, do you feel any kind of responsibility And if so, how would you describe that?
I feel that my responsibility is try to keep the story alive. It's true that the atomic bomb is a horrible weapon. I'm glad it was used, glad it's never been used again. It is a horrible weapon. But it did what it was designed to do, and that was stop that war. People say, well, there are alternatives. Well, let's look at the alternative. The first one on the list is to invade Japan, and they had scheduled that for November 1st of that same year. They estimated that there would be at least 1 million lives lost on either side, Americans and Japanese. So you're talking 2 million people opposed to the number of people that were killed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
So when this movie comes out and people watch it all over the world, and some start to try to stir that debate up again and say, in retrospect, it never should have been used. And we see how J. Robert Oppenheimer wrestled with the weight of history, but also knew it hadn't been used in an act of war since. What do you want to say? Because you're the last person who was connected to this project from a military sense in your bomb group, in your composite group. What do you want to say about it? What should people really know and understand? Or how do you respond to those people who say, you know, we really shouldn't have?
I say you're foolish. You weren't out there in the Pacific. A lot of those guys had been crawling around in muds and getting infected with diseases from the mosquitoes and were tired and weary and just wanted to go home. You know, they wanted to have the war over, and this thing did that for them. No question in my mind at all that it was the right thing to do, because it did stop the war. The Japanese people were so dedicated to their emperor that they were willing to have the whole nation give up their lives in honor of the emperor. That was their faith, their religion. They worshiped the guy. As far as I'm concerned, he had his blood on his hands, too, for approving the beginning of the war. For the Pearl Harbor attack, he put his blessings on that attack on December 6th, 1941, and that mission was inflicted against us at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. So the day before that happened, he put his blessings on it. So he had blood on his hands. How they could worship the man that put their country through what it went through. You know, you hear so much about the number of people that were killed by the atomic bombs. Yes, there were a lot of people killed. You never hear anything about the napalm bombing that went on to the city of Tokyo, where the city of Tokyo was completely obliterated from dropping napalm bombs. The napalm substance is a gelatin substance that, when ignited, you cannot extinguish it. And it literally burned Tokyo down and killed more lives, did more property damage than the two atomic bombs did together. Where is the criticism for that as opposed to the dropping of the bombs that ended that war?
And is there anything else I didn't ask you that you want to say that gives you perspective on all of this with the way you see the world?
I was very young at the time, and it was a great honor and an exciting time to be part of such a great project. Never really had ever heard of the Manhattan Project before the 393rd Bomb Squadron got transferred to Wendover and found that we would be incorporated into the group that would be responsible for receiving those bombs from the people that developed them and deliver them to Japan and to end that war. I think it was the right thing to do, and I'm glad they've never been used again. I hope they never will, but I'm sure at some point in time, maybe not in my days, I don't have that many years left, this country will see probably atomic bombs used against them by people that have been helped and developed to improve their lives, hate us so much that they want to annihilate us. I have to ponder that film for some time and try to remember all that I heard about Oppenheimer through the years. And it's sad that our group is gone. Our group took a lot of criticism after the war, as if we had developed that bomb to drop it in the whole works. But all we did was carry out military missions that were given to us by our country to help end the World War II.
the final word from the final surviving member of the 509th Composite Group. And one more little aside on Norris Jernigan. He's only 98. I say only because you can hear how sharp and engaged he remains. He does have a plan for when he hits the century mark in June of 2025. He made his first trip to Israel a few years ago and has enjoyed returning since. He plans to be in the Holy Land when he celebrates birthday number 100. Who knows? Maybe we'll have another story to tell by then. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.